Metallica, here they come, the kings of metal!
Hey, this is Avi from Goodnight, Texas, and you are listening to Metal Up Your Podcast.
Trust I seek and I find in you. Every day for us something new. Open mind for a different view. And nothing else matters.
Welcome to Metal Up Your Podcast. I'm Ethan Luck.
And I'm Clint Wells.
This is episode 245. We're going to be talking about the Woodstock 99 documentary. This might end up being a couple-part series.
We'll have to see how the combo goes. First of all, how about that Phoebe Bridgers cover?
My God, it's so good, man. I got chills the first time I listened to it, and I just did it again.
Wow. Just keep getting more excited for the Blacklist.
I know. I got to say, like, originally, you see the list of all the artists that are on it, I wasn't as excited as I thought I would be now. You know what I mean? Like now that they're coming out, you know, and we're to Nothing Else Matters, it's like, man, there's a lot of great versions on here.
I am really excited. I can't really say what it is yet, but we will be having an artist that is featured on the Blacklist as a guest next week.
Right.
And I'm excited to have that conversation because we're going to sort of learn a little bit about how it all went down. And,
yeah.
You know, I did learn... about the videos that are being made. Some speculation about whether or not they're making their own music videos.
Right.
So we're going to have a guest next week that I think you guys are going to enjoy talking to. And Phoebe Bridgers is just a badass anyway.
Oh, she's already a badass. Yeah, her music's amazing. Do you ever listen to her, the thing she did with Julian Baker called Boy Genius?
No.
It's an EP they did. And forgive me, I know that Phoebe's probably listening. I forget the third girl that's involved in that, but it's a really great EP.
She hops around a lot. I mean, I recommend her album Stranger in the Alps. She also did an EP before that called Killer that's really good.
Yeah.
But then she's in a band with Connor Oberst.
Yeah.
She did the thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
She's busy. She's a busy lady.
She's a force, man.
And just a great writer.
Absolutely.
All right. And I'm glad she's a part of it. It's just, I'm not going to be able to live this down or let this go. It's just the chef's kiss genius of the Blacklist.
I know, man. It's really good.
Is getting all these great different artists involved. Like it reminds, Kiss did a thing like this in the mid-90s called Kiss My Ass. And it was like, you know, it was like the Jim Blossoms and the Lemonheads.
Yeah.
Anthrax is on it.
Cool.
And it was, the whole deal was like, this whole new generation is introducing our music to their fans.
Right, yeah.
But this is... easily the most ambitious and coolest one I've ever seen.
Yeah.
There are lots of tribute records.
Of course.
You can go to Walmart and find all kinds of weird Metallica tribute albums with bands I've never heard of.
Yeah.
How do they even do that?
There's a ton of those out there.
But damn, I mean, Chris Stapleton and...
Yeah, man. I was texting my friend Andy, who's Chris Stapleton's touring photographer. He was in the studio while he recorded it, and he just posted a couple photos of them recording that song.
Mm-hmm.
And I had brought that up to him while we were texting. I said, man, Metallica is just so smart for like, it's not like more people need to hear the Black Album, but all these fans of these other artists are now getting introduced to Metallica in the way that they know of this particular artist.
Yeah. Or what's, you know, Metallica is just not a band that I think needs to be introduced, but I do think there's a lot of fans of these other bands that are like, if you were to be like, hey, Metallica, they're like, yeah, whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Now they kind of have an anchor point.
Yeah, a Phoebe Bridgers fan might not, she might know Enter Sandman, they might know Enter Sandman, or they've, oh yeah, so-and-so I know listens to that band.
Yeah.
Then they hear this and they're like, whoa, I love Phoebe Bridgers. I love this song. Oh, this is a Metallica? Wow.
And it speaks to just the huge impact and influence of the album, where you got guys like Chris, Jason Isbell, alongside metal guys and hard rock guys, Billy Clyro or whatever. Everyone's like, yeah, I was influenced by that album.
Mm-hmm.
Miley Cyrus is influenced by the album.
For sure.
Elton John was influenced by the album.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So anyway, it continues to unfold. Black Album turned 30.
Aww.
Aww.
All grown up.
I remember when I turned 30
a couple
of years ago.
I did 12 years ago for me. No, it's exciting, man. And, you know, as you know, I definitely listen to the Black Album somewhat regularly, you know. But I couldn't help myself, you know.
Did you put it on?
I put it on. Yeah. Yesterday morning, well, I was recording this yesterday morning, got up, took care of my pups, threw that thing on. And every time I throw it on the turntable, I'm constantly blown away at the low end on that record.
Hmm.
It's just, there's not many records in my collection that when I put it on, like, my speakers react that way. You know,
your speakers are like, this is awesome.
My speakers, they told both of them told me they're twins.
Yeah.
Identical.
That's good.
But I remember just like I was in the kitchen making coffee and I kind of came back into our den where my A rig is.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like I stopped and I was like, it was the beginning of Sandman when the toms came out. I was just like, Jesus.
Yeah.
It's like the mixing and mastering that record are just.
I don't know. Another chef's kiss. That's two. We're going to do a chef's kiss counter.
Yeah, that's number two.
For this episode.
Yeah.
And we'll do another one. We talk about people rubbing shit all over themselves at Woodstock thinking it's mud. That's
exactly,
going to be a chef's kiss too. So happy birthday to the Black Album. Yay. It's the year of the Black Album.
I know, man. It's great.
And Metallica, a lot of people want to know what we think about this. So let's talk about this. Metallica has announced that they made a podcast called the Metallica Podcast. They're dropping 8 episodes. I believe it's August 20th.
Mm-hmm.
So a week from the recording of this.
Good luck, boys. It's tough out there.
People keep asking us what we think about it, and I think it's awesome.
It's great. I mean, do I want to hear 8 episodes of The Boys of Metallica, which, by the way, posted like 3 hours ago, Jason is involved, Bob Rock.
That's right.
It's like, do I want to hear all 5 of those dudes talk about the Black Album? Of course I do.
Yeah.
Would I rather it be on Metal Up Your Podcast? Sure. Of course. But, I mean, look, like these dudes aren't idiots. We know this. Like, as far as like giving us great content and stuff that we're all just going to eat up, especially for an album as successful as the Black Album, yes, I'll take all the content. Yeah. If you want to give me any extra content that I have not heard yet, I'm going to listen to it.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. We'll see how it goes. You know, it may just be sort of this limited thing to promote the Black Album. It may be something they do sporadically to promote new tours or a new record, or it may just be a weekly outlet, you know, for them to get together. And even if it's short, even if it's just Lars, they do, like, I could see them doing like a segment that's like, you know, this week in Metallica's history, and they look back at some, you know, monumental week in their amazing career to highlight an era. And it's definitely good for pushing merch. I mean, it's just all that stuff. It's cool. I can't wait.
I mean, yeah, the excitement about the Black Album this entire year has been great. I mean, I'm already like looking online, like, you know, I need that Sabbath True shirt again. Haven't had that since junior high.
I think it's on sale because I got the Flaming Skull guy.
Nice.
Which is another.
Dude, wrong era, bro.
Well, 94. but I was looking at also those classic shirts. Yeah. And the Sabbath True one is, I think it's on sale.
That was one of my favorite ones.
Yeah.
You know, I'm gonna have to order that today.
Well, you know, the new Vans I got.
Those are great.
It's the Sabbath True.
Yeah.
Each of them have that skull that's looking at each other.
I know a few of our listeners got those. I think Narmada got them.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are pretty sick.
Okay, so that's kind of basically the news. And we want to thank our new patrons. We got some new patrons this week. Jay Aragama, Brandon Tincher, and Dennis Bredeman. Thank you, guys. We appreciate you guys on the Patreon train. It means a lot to us. It's a way to support the show with your hard-earned dollars.
That's right.
But basically just like buying us a beer a month. It's basically $5 is the most common tier. You can do $10 a month, $25 a month. And we have several hardcore Patreon members that are at the $50 tier.
Yeah, man. They're really, really committed.
Shout out to you guys. But just the $5 really goes a long way, because if enough of you knuckleheads out there do it, it helps the podcast make sense. It helps us pay for the associated costs with running the websites and all the hosting. It helps us make merch. It helps us pay our friends who, like Tim Brown, who does artwork for us.
Yeah,
it helps
totally.
Us pay for mixing and mastering of the cover of our Blackened EPs. When we, you know, throw these parties, mm-hmm. it helps us, which we have an announcement about a party coming up. So anyway, it's just a way for you to support the show. If you're wondering, how can I support the show?
Right.
Maybe you're sitting on the toilet right now asking that very question out loud.
Hey, you're sitting there, you're taking your deuce for the morning, and you're like, I wish there was something more I could do.
And that's what you can do. Now, the iTunes contest that's happening right now is, if you leave us a positive review in the States, we will send you a Metal Up Your Podcast patch.
That's correct.
Limited production run of patches.
Limited, of course.
With what are we calling that? Our splatter logo?
Splatter logo. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also our limited edition zombie picks are now for sale. $5 anywhere in the world. We will send them to you. What else do we have? Oh, okay. In the socials, so we're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Spotify, YouTube. We are now on Amazon Music and Audible.
Yeah, I saw that. That's exciting. We had a few people asking about it.
Some people have been asking, and we're now there.
So I'm pretty sure there's nowhere you can't listen to us at this point. You might even be able to put us on a jukebox at a bar. I don't know.
Wow.
Could you imagine? someone's listening to Achy Breaky Heart, and then you put on like
episode 124,
the Jay Weinberg episode 3. That'd be incredible.
Wow. How many quarters would that require?
Just 3.
Just 3 quarters?
Yeah. It's a bargain. Yeah, wow. For sure.
All right. Listen, there's a Metal Up Your Podcast in between party, a night between party. What does that mean? That means that at Louder Than Life in Louisville in late September, there's going to be a Metal Up Your Podcast sanctioned hang mm-hmm. on the 25th, which is Saturday. The venue is to be announced. There's right. still there. And by the way, we're not going to be there. We're going to be on right. tour,
which is why it's sanctioned.
But a bunch of our friends and supporters of the show want to get together and throw a party.
Yeah. And they're wanting to make it a kick-ass party as yeah. if we were there.
Yeah.
You know, they want to do right by us.
Yeah. I mean, we're sending them along with raffle giveaways. We're going to mm-hmm. be, and Namarda already told me that her and you're just were talking about maybe donating some stuff for giveaways. We usually give out vinyl and rare crap.
Oh, yeah.
And any, at the very least, though, you know, what's really special about those hangs is just a place for Metal Up Your Podcast people to get together.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not a little clique. It's not a club. Anyone's welcome. Everyone is very friendly, very nice. Mm-hmm. And but here's what they need is they need an RSVP count because they're right. trying to figure out what kind of venue to book.
Yeah.
The venue will be close to the Louder Than Life venue. Mm-hmm. There's an Eventbrite page. If you look down in your podcast app where all the notes are, we will have a link to this event.
Right.
All you do, it's free. You just RSVP.
Yeah, they just want a head count because that's going to determine which venue it's going to be at.
So everyone just put it in your calendars, honey, please.
Oh, it's so easy. Put it in your day planner.
The easiest way to get a hold of us is metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com. Someone wrote in and said, hey, I've been sending you emails, but I haven't been putting show in it.
Oh, my gosh. So just metalupyourpodcast@gmail.com,
yeah, yeah.
which was taken. I looked it up.
Well, I think if you send an email to metalupyourpodcast.com, it goes into like a black hole, a portal, if you will.
Yeah.
And they all just land in Samim's house. An actual physical letter. Even if you sent an email
yeah.
through the portal, it turns into a physical letter.
Yeah, it really does. And it kind of floats down like slowly, like you know.
Like the feather in Forrest Gump.
Exactly, yeah.
While that little theme music plays and I cry.
And it lands in Samim's lap every time.
Now, that's just stone cold science.
Yes.
Those are hard facts. That's what happens.
I mean, facts matter, Clint, and that's what we're here to deliver, okay?
So you have to send it to metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com. We love hearing from you guys. We're going to read 6 emails now before we talk about Woodstock 99. So let's do it.
I'm ready. All right, our first email is from Smalls the Time Lord.
How about that name, dude?
That's top 5 already.
Smalls the Time Lord.
Hi, my name is Smalls the Time Lord.
And this time it's personal.
Good night, Dark Continent. We are Smalls the Time Lord.
All right, Smalls. All right, Smalls the Time Lord.
I found your podcast recently while trying to find a Kirk Hammett interviews on Spotify. Couldn't find any. But I did find your guys' Kirk Hammett episode and have listened to several episodes since then. Sometimes I forget what the episode is about because you guys have such an interesting conversations during the email segments of the show.
Nice.
Thank you, Noice.
Nice.
I really like the episodes where you get into the band's gear. Sincerely, Smalls the Time Lord.
Thank you, Smalls the
Gotta
Time Lord.
Gotta get back in time, Lord. I'm feeling
Thank
silly
you.
Today, Clint. Me and Clint were up past our bedtime last night at the Kings of Leon show.
That's right. We saw Kings of Leon last night.
We did. I saw them for the first time ever from not the side of the stage.
Really?
Same with Cold War Kids. I worked for both of those bands at one point, and I had never seen them outside of working for them. So let me get in my,
well, first of all, I'm in the lounge position.
You are. I'll get there
I'm waiting
soon.
For you to lounge up.
I mean, I can.
I'm not trying to force you. Lounge at your own leisure.
It's like, would you like to lounge, be more comfortable and maybe, I don't know, look kind of cool? Then, you know what? All right, I'm in lounge
position. No one looks cooler than me in a Denver Nuggets jersey with my Michael Jordan socks.
Are those Jordan socks?
Oh, yeah, baby.
I didn't see. Oh, there it is. There's a logo. My guess was Superman socks, but.
You know, I love Superman, but I don't have any Superman clothing.
I might take the lounge sitch one step further, and I do this at Paul's studio a lot, HQ3. Little pillow on the lap.
Yeah. I always have a pillow on my lap.
Oh, dude. My gosh. I might fall asleep in this episode to see.
That's fine. So how did it feel? Like, you know, let me put my little psychiatrist hat on.
Okay.
How did it feel to be on that side of it? Obviously, you're seeing the behind the scenes of your buddies. Chris Coleman was on stage.
Yeah.
You were at front of house with who I'm sure you're friends with, the front of house guy.
Yeah, Brent. Yeah.
How did it feel?
It was cool. You know, it was definitely, I don't mean this in a bad way, but I was very thankful that I'm playing with you
mm-hmm.
and Morgan.
That sounds right.
Because I was looking on stage like during set change, and there was part of me that was like, oh, look, there's Nacho and there's Nate and the mm-hmm. dudes that I hung with every day.
Yeah.
But there's another part of me that was like, man, I'm stoked for them and this tour. Obviously, like, there was plenty of tickets sold last night, but I was like, I knew I made the right call by leaving that camp and moving on to Morgan.
Yeah.
You know, but so with all that said, I felt like I was really able to like step away from that job and just enjoy the show yeah. as a spectator. I didn't take one photo. I didn't take no video. I just sat back and watched, and I was standing behind this dude, Hunter, who's a sweet dude. He's their LD. That means lighting director.
Mm-hmm. So it was just biz. That's biz talk.
It's biz talk. Yeah, as an LD. I was out at front of house, which is FOH for, you know,
for biz.
But it was cool. You know, I really enjoyed it. I thought the mix sounded great. I don't know. I know you guys were kind of, you and your wife were kind of back on the grass a bit, but mm-hmm. obviously being right behind front of house, it's going to sound, you know, at least maybe not best to you, but best to whoever's mixing front of house. But Brent's been mixing those dudes from day one. So he knows his stuff. And I had a great time. I really enjoyed it.
I was there because it's my wife's favorite band.
Yes.
And
I've when I was working for the band, side note, there are more Kings of Leon posters in the Wells household than there are Metallica posters, and that's yeah. because of yours truly.
Thank you for doing well, thank you and fuck you.
even after I had stopped working for them, their old bass tech came through town because he was selling a house here, and he had two more Kings Leon posters. He's like, do you want these? I was like, I'm good, but I know someone that does, and I brought them to your wife. So there's even more.
I think it's important to make room in your world for the things that your spouse loves.
Of course.
That's just part of how you love them.
Yeah, for
sure. Oh my God, dude. I read an incredible David Shields quote this morning that said, love is giving someone something you don't have who does not want it. I was like, oh, fuck.
Okay.
Love is giving something you don't have to someone who doesn't want it. That resonated with me quite deeply.
Interesting. Okay.
And I think that...
So if I, let's say I bought a snake bite. I don't have one. My wife definitely doesn't want one.
Mm-hmm. You give it to her.
And I give it to her. Yeah. That's true love.
Exactly. That's the definition of love.
Okay. I'll say this. I'm taking a mental note of that for her birthday this year.
Okay.
Babe, I got you a snake bite.
Clint said the coolest thing the other day.
It's an amazing quote, and I thought you would just be so touched by this. She'd be like, you're going to return that.
She's like, love is me punching you in the crotch.
It's like her giving me a
with
Morrissey
brass
record.
Knuckles, yeah. You wouldn't want a Morrissey record?
I actually do own one Morrissey record. I've never been a huge Morrissey fan. I like the Smiths, but a lot of his songs just kind of bore me. But the record called Years of Refusal,
mm-hmm.
it was kind of like that punk record he did. Yeah. Dude, it's fucking awesome.
Yeah. I mean, if you like the Smiths, you'll like Morrissey.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I think I prefer just the songs. Every time I hear Morrissey, when my wife puts it on, I'm like, it's fine. It's cool. You know,
it's a very, affected vocal vibe. It's very them.
Kind of has this thing going on. It's almost like an Aaron Neville.
It's a good Morrissey impression.
I've practiced because I've made fun of him in front of my wife.
give me another taste of that.
The more you ignore me, closer I get.
It is kind of an Aaron Neville thing.
Without the vibrato. Now, if you do vibrato, it's...
Heaven knows I'm miserable now.
Right. But with vibrato, it's Aaron Neville. It's a...
Don't know much. But I know I love you. Thank you. All right, let's move on. Jesus. Dennis Bredeman, who's a new patron, by the way. Thank you, Dennis. He says, hey, guys, just dropping you a note to say thank you. I've been a casual Metallica fan since the Black Album, but over the winter, I started playing guitar and realized that all the riffs I wanted to learn were Metallica riffs.
Yes.
When I mentioned that to a friend and a Metal Up Your Podcast patron, he told me to check out the podcast. I did, and over the last 7 months, I've gone through every numbered episode to get all caught up. And I've also gone down the rabbit hole of live Metallica shows on YouTube.
Yes.
I've never seen Metallica live since I don't go to many shows. He says, I don't like to be around large groups of people. I feel the same way, my homie. He says, but listening to your shows convinced me that I need to get off my ass and see them in person. You also convinced me to sign up to be a fifth member. And it's those two things that I have to thank you for, because a couple of weeks ago, everything came together and I was able to get tickets to the 40th anniversary shows.
Awesome.
I'm proud to be a new patron and hoping to see you and some of the Metal Up Your Podcast family in December at my first Metallica show. Keep up the great work. Dennis Bredeman, which he told me how to pronounce it down here, from Cincinnati, Ohio, New Jersey.
Of course.
Well, here's the deal, Dennis. As you know now, because you've been on the ride for 7 months, we change lives. We take a life
right.
that's fine.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with
that life. Nothing wrong with the life. It's a good life.
Yeah.
But we kick it up a notch. We change it.
Yeah. Kick into high gear, man. That's what we do.
Listen, before we came into your life, Dennis, you did not have tickets to Metallica.
Listen, I'll quote the great Morrissey. The more you ignore us, the closer we get.
Shoplifters of the world. I love the Smiths, dude.
The Smiths are great. I
will. You do admit, have to be in the mood for it.
I need to dive a little deeper. But I mean, I love that. The 80s Smith stuff. Even Johnny Marr solo stuff's got some cool shit.
Oh, well, that's what, to me, the magic of the Smiths is Johnny Marr. Yeah. And I vastly prefer it over Morrissey solo stuff. Although I like Morrissey solo stuff too. Because I like Morrissey's point of view. And he's smart and acerbic. And, you know, he wasn't writing She Doesn't Love Me crap.
Right.
He was like writing really interesting songs, kind of David Byrne-ish. But it's really Johnny Marr that brings that the musical magic.
Yeah, I mean it's that combo for some that many great
Chinese
bands,
thing.
You know, Joe Perry and Steven Tyler, and you have to, you know.
I love that you went there.
I'm just thinking of like the lead singer guitar
Joe P
combo.
And Steve T.
You got to put the brio on that. But you know that thing, the Jimmy Page and Robert Plant, that kind of vibe.
Yeah,
Keith and Mick, right? Keith and Mick,
Dave Matthews and Boyd Tinsley,
exactly. Oh,
okay.
Geez.
Well, next email.
Next email is from Glenn Merritt. Fellas, I checked out, went off the reservation, go on and off the boat, et cetera, et cetera. The Black Album, but y'all got me back.
He's saying he got off the ride at the Black Album, but
right,
we got him back.
Right. Got off the ride at the Black Album. Listen, again, we're making dreams come true.
Yeah, changing lives.
The more you ignore the Black Album, the closer we get.
we give you something we don't have, which is a Black Album box set, which is something you didn't want in 1991.
See?
And that's what love is.
I want to know what love
Thank
is.
Thank you. Want you to show. Thank you.
Thank you. Glenn says, I love and hate you equally. I love your podcast and have fun always. I'm a patron guy and will always give y'all dough.
Nice.
Thank you. Like pizza. Y'all have jazzed up my 53-year-old self. Love y'all. P.S. Don't hate on Florida. It's a shit show, but a fun place. Hey, listen, man. Listen, Florida is just the easy state to make fun of. It just is.
Sure. Well, okay.
Listen, I spend my cash dollars a couple times a year in Florida. I go to Fort Walton.
Okay.
I hang on the panhandle.
I've been known to go to Rosemary Beach, to go to Destin.
This is a frequent place we go for my wife's birthday often, yeah, or our friends, his birthdays in general. We like to
go. You like to do birthdays in Florida, huh?
Well,
you were born. Let's go to Florida.
Well, listen, I mean...
Listen, kid, you were born. We want to celebrate that you were born.
I have to go to Florida. How do you think the Joyces... How do you think we've mastered that voice?
Honey, please.
Honey,
it gets
please.
So cold. When I'm in Yonkers, I get super cold.
Oh, it's bone chilling.
And Lucius shivers. He gets in bed with me and shivers. And Lucius says to me in doggy language that I understand. He says, Mommy, please.
I don't think we've ever clarified that Lucius is from the Middle Ages.
Take me to Florida. And I'm like, honey, please, your wish is my command.
Of course. Where do you want to go? Rosemary Beach? You want to go for Lucius, Destin? Orange
listen,
Beach?
When my sweetie Lucius says jump, I say, how high?
That's right.
Who does this?
How far south?
How far south can I jump? I'll jump all the way to Rosemary
Beach. You
want to
go to the Keys?
You want to go to the Florida Keys?
Or Gainesville to go see Michael Bolton?
We could go to Gainesville and see the Bolt Man.
Of course.
I love when he sings that song, When a Man Loves a Woman. And also when he sings his hit song, I told you I loved you, but I lied.
I prefer, I want to touch you. Can I touch you?
There.
There.
Yeah. Sometimes in my secret heart, I imagine where he wants to touch me, and guess what? It is there.
That's right.
Right there.
I mean, it's the Bolt Man.
You know, he touches me there regardless.
How can he not?
And you know where there is? Get your mind out of the gutter, Joyce. There's my heart.
And soul.
Anyway, the heat's lovely down there. We love Florida.
We love the heat.
Okay. Michael Salazar writes in, what's up, my brothers? Proud patron Michael Salazar here. I loved all the Big Four episodes, so thank you for those. They were episodes I've been looking forward to for a while. He says, real quick about the Slayer Big Four Am I Evil Jam. He says, I remembered a picture in an old Guitar World magazine of Kerry King standing next to James on stage in Nebworth, England. Did they do more jams and Slayer went on stage after the Bulgaria show? I've attached a picture so you can see. So I looked this up, and yes, the next summer they did a run of shows they weren't Big Four shows, but those other bands were on the bill.
Right.
And the picture he sent me was from July 8th, 2011. All the same members from the Bulgaria show were on stage, but also Diamond Head was on stage with him, mm-hmm. Brian Tatler, the guy from Diamond Head, Scott Ian wasn't there, so Andreas Kisser of Sepultura was there in his place, and of course Hanneman was not there at that time, so right. Gary Holt of Exodus joined them. So, you know, Kerry King did humble himself and come out and play a song, but I looked at all the other dates around that,
yeah.
and every night they did a jam. Sometimes it was a different song.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was Die My Darling. He never did another one.
Yeah. It was awkward, man. I mean, that interaction with them backstage was just weird. I don't know if Hanneman was, it was him just, he's an introvert. He was dealing with alcoholism or whatever. And, or maybe he looks at James as like a poser. I don't know. Is Hanneman, was he a true till the end?
Hard to tell.
I don't know.
It's really hard to know. All right. He goes on to say, also I have a quick question. Why do you think that Rob and Kirk's microphones are off sometimes? I wondered if maybe it was just mistakes by crew, or do Rob and Kirk just generally sing at a low volume live? I only ask because I never recalled seeing Newstead's mics being off on any live footage I've seen with him. Obviously, Jason was louder and more confident than Rob and Kirk. However, the mic seems to be okay when James sings into them. Just thought I'd ask you guys since you're the pros. Honey, please.
Oh, yes.
Hope you're well, and please, please tell Torben I said hello. It's been too long since we've heard from him.
Many greetings.
And I hope he's doing well. Peace and adios. Michael Salazar, Brook, Indiana, New Jersey. Is Torben around?
Just stopped by for a second. Just here momentarily. The wind started blowing, and I just got on the carpet.
Let me ask you something, Torben.
Yes, of course.
You know, I don't know what the climate's like in Denmark, but do you ever get down to Florida? Oh, really? Well, do you ever get down to Florida?
Oh, yes. I love Florida. It's great. You know, a lot of people describe it as America's penis. That's just what I hear in Denmark.
Wow, I've never heard that.
Well, if you look at it, it's kind of phallic.
Oh, right. Well, interesting. Some people say you see what you want to see also.
Oh, yes, and I fly high above my carpet, so I see a lot more than most people.
Well, I'm going to let you get going, Tor. We just wanted to, you know, Michael wanted to hear from you. We wanted to make sure you're okay. We'll see you soon, buddy.
Great to be here. I'll say this. I definitely don't think it's mistakes by crew.
No, it's definitely not.
Metallica do not hire people. Yes, mistakes can happen. Things can go wrong. But in general, a band of that caliber, really, if you're hiring crew people, the hope is mistakes never happen.
Yeah.
Sometimes they can happen. But something like that.
But it's rare. I would say it's rare, and it's usually out of their control.
Yes. It's something technical that's going wrong or something like that. A mic breaks down a cable.
They're not
like
forgetting that. To turn a mic on.
No, I think there's points in the set where Kirk or Rob might be singing, and you know, you're right, they're not as strong a singer as Jason. I don't think even close. Jason was just on 11 the yeah. whole time, you know. But you know, Hetfield's the main voice, and it's probably in there a little bit, you know, yeah. for certain parts. And I mean, that fader's being ridden.
They're just right. That's exactly what it is. They're probably riding a fader, and when James, and you know, they do this cool thing where James is really not tied down to any mic. So I get that Michael and maybe someone who doesn't know as much about it, they're like, but when he goes and sings in Rob's mic, I hear James. But
yeah.
when Rob sings in it, I don't hear Rob. They're riding the faders,
mm-hmm.
and they're probably doing that because Rob and Kirk's vocals are such that they sound best when they're blended more
yeah.
in. And now Jason was able to just be this ferocious. It's exactly a confidence and a volume thing. Jason came up and was ferocious.
His mic was actually off the whole time.
he was just screaming that loud over the PA.
Yeah, he could stream. He could scream at like 110 decibels.
So it's really as simple as that, but it's definitely not a mistake.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, a couple more emails.
All right, Jesse Ball writes, hey guys, I got my Lunar Satan vinyl a couple weeks ago and I was nice. Super excited.
Nice.
I've never held a record that thick before. Hey, get your man out of the gutter, first of all. Second,
thank you.
I was going to say, so is it 180 gram?
Yeah.
One thing I noted when I was jamming my Lunar Satan vinyl when he mm-hmm. gave it to me, the cut around the side mm-hmm. is very squared off.
Hmm.
Have you noticed that?
No.
Compared to most vinyl, where it kind of tapers off, right?
Hmm.
Just the edge of the record. Yours is like a straight, hard cut. And it was kind of rad looking.
I've never noticed.
I've just never seen anything like that before. I noticed when I felt it right away.
I've never seen or looked at or heard my vinyl.
I looked at the record and said, can I touch you there?
There.
And
he did, honey, please.
Anyway, so Jesse goes on to say, that's my second one after the SNM2 Deluxe. I haven't been able to listen to them yet because I don't have a record player, but my wife knows that's my biggest want for Christmas or my B-Day coming up. I still rock the digital version in regular rotation. I'm currently listening to Tangent City Part 2 and had to slow down for a bit because I'm going to be so bummed to be caught up after listening to the show in order. I hope things are starting up for you boys again. Total tour Lunar Satan in Canada. Take it easy, Jesse.
The Canadians love Lunar Satan.
Oh, man. I mean, it's like if you go to Calgary, it's like the rodeo, and country music's huge, and then Lunar Satan.
Yeah, right.
Right below that.
It's funny you just mentioned that in Calgary. My wife and I were talking last night about when Nova was born, And I had to leave the hospital to fly to go play a country music festival in Calgary.
Oh, wow. Crazy.
I remember being up there. I was with an artist I love named Jada Dreyer, who I write with all the time now. But I remember being up there, like, not with my new baby and my wife, being like, what the fuck am I doing?
Right.
Playing country music in Canada.
When I found out how big country music was up in Calgary, it blew my mind. I was like, what? Why?
It's huge.
Like, why?
It's big in Vancouver, too.
And then when I got there, like, the first time I went to Calgary, it was probably in, like, 98, 99. And I see people in, like, cowboy hats.
Mm.
This is weird.
Dude, one of the weirdest things I've ever done is I went and played a show in Milan, Italy, with Laura Bell Bundy at a country music festival.
Wow.
It was in this big, like, rodeo thing, completely packed. Everyone wearing, like, Jack Daniel shirts, cowboy boots, cowboy hats. No one spoke English.
Jack Daniel shirts.
Yeah.
So they were, like, Tennessee. Like,
they just loved, like, the culture and the aesthetic of Nashville, Tennessee country music. It was wild.
That reminds me, John Davis, when Superdrag was still touring, told me the story one time. We were talking about Japan because I was about to go at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one that told me, like, hey, in between songs, the audience gets real quiet.
Yeah.
And he said that at one point, one dude out of nowhere in the crowd, they were quiet. John goes, hey, we're Superdrag. We're from Tennessee. And this guy goes, Jack Daniels! Like, as loud as he could over the most quiet crowd.
Yeah.
Because that's what Tennessee, they know it's on the bottle.
They immediately had him killed.
He's not around anymore.
Okay, I guess that's some dark humor there.
It was.
New Lunar Satan song, single dropping on my birthday, Lord of the Vampires.
Hell yeah.
September 9th.
September 9th.
So be on the lookout for that. Our last email from J. Lloyd Jr. Hey guys, just a quick one to first of all apologize for being so late to the damn party. You know what? Should we forgive him?
Of course.
All right, we forgive you.
We just met.
We just had a meeting of the minds, and we just had a staff meeting just now.
We did. That was our staff meeting.
You want to have a Metal Beer Podcast staff meeting real quick?
Yeah.
Should we forgive him?
Yeah.
All right. Meeting adjourned. He says, as an obsessive son of a bee, and I put the abbreviation on that because you know what? Sometimes I clean up my language.
Sometimes you do.
Sometimes I let it fly.
I'm fucking proud of you for that.
Sometimes I let it fly real loose.
Yes.
But I'm gonna choose J. Lloyd Jr. to clean this first sentence up.
Okay.
As an obsessive son of a bee, I tend to dip in and out of things, and a recent watch of the Woodstock 99 documentary, I'm currently eyeball deep in a Metallica binge. I have an eclectic taste, but I consider Metallica quote-unquote home territory ever since my cousin placed a set of headphones on my head and insisted I listen to Harvester of Sorrow, which blew my tiny mind and my world wide open.
With worlds wide open.
Thank you. Under the Thank you. Finding Metal Up Your Podcast has been a highlight of this recent catch-up after over a decade away and consuming everything I've missed. I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on Metallica ever doing one of these metaverse in-game gigs. I know the thought of them rocking out in Fortnite is a little sickening, but as a band that have prided themselves on being at the forefront of technology, surely the thought has crossed their mind. I can imagine highlights such as an avatar of Cliff jamming bells with the band, not to mention the flattering BTS of them in those ever-so-flattering morph suits. Thanks for everything and keep it up. Yours would be Hulkamaniac, Junior.
I don't know enough about gaming. I mean, can you do that? I wish we could interview my nephew right now about Fortnite. He could talk all about it.
Right.
Is that a thing? I guess that is, where like artists can be in the game.
I also do not know.
I play Nintendo.
I mean, how about, you know, I mean, they're in Guitar Hero.
There's a whole game about them.
Yeah.
I own that.
Does that count?
I have a PS2 and an NES Classic. That's about as gamey as I get these days.
I have, man.
Don't you have the Super Nintendo Classic?
I have the Super Nintendo Classic, and we have the Sega Classic.
Ooh.
And the Sega Classic's way better.
Is Altered Beast on there?
Oh, yeah. The Super NES Classic only came with like 30 games.
That's what the original, both of those are that way.
And you can't put cartridges in it. And
no,
you can't download.
You can't hack them, actually.
Hack the planet! But the Sega one came with like 200 games.
Really?
And you can put cartridges in it.
Interesting. How much is that one? I kind of want that.
$90.
Really?
Yeah.
My birthday's coming up in October.
Hey. But I have to give you something that I don't have that you don't want.
No, that's right. So. That's right.
I'm going to give you a Porcupine wrist cuff signed by Carrie King's mom.
I don't have that.
I know.
I don't know if I want it.
Nor do you want it. That's why I have to give it to you. Because that's what love is.
I want to know what love
Thank
is.
You!
Thank you.
Thank you.
Want you to show, Steve.
So I guess the way to answer this is we don't know enough about it to have it informed. But I am glad you mentioned Woodstock 99 because that's what we're about to talk about.
You're not
going to
believe this.
I guess it's that simple. Metal Up Your Podcast show at gmail.com. Write into us. Ask us your zany questions. Who knows what can happen?
We'll get nutty.
In the email portal. Well, here's what we can guarantee, Stone Cold. Well, we can guarantee two things.
Okay.
Things are going to get nutty.
Yep.
and we're going to have fun always.
I mean,
those are Metal Beat Podcast guarantees. Nary to change.
And they're kind of two things in one because getting nutty is a part of having fun always.
You know what? To simplify it, let's go ahead and roll those into one. You could put so many things under the have fun always
column.
Oh
my gosh,
dude.
Yeah.
I'm urinating right now, and I can put that in that column.
I did like 10 minutes
just
ago.
Just because it's fun.
Why do you think I'm crossing my legs now?
Is that why you put the pillow in your lap?
No.
All right, metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com. Let's get out of here, and you're going to hear a Patreon commercial. If you can, you're willing and able, think about supporting the show. You're going to get a whole bunch of stuff and access to bonus features and all that stuff. It's all there, honey, please, and we'll see you in a minute.
All right.
Hey, everyone. Clint and Ethan here, and we want to tell you about a little thing called Patreon. Patreon is an easy and interactive way to support the people who make the things that you love.
For as little as $5 a month, you can ensure that Metal Up Your Podcast can continue to grow in quality and content. That's equivalent to a cup of coffee or a beer once a month.
Not only is it easy and affordable, but we've made it a priority since day one to give back to our Patreon community. We've given away deluxe box sets, rare vinyl, Black and Whiskey,
concert tickets to S&M2 and Slane Castle,
all four of our Cover Our World Black and EPs, 26 quarantine covers, and Lunar Satan demos,
invitations to exclusive Zoom happy hours, the ability to ask our guests like Jay Weinberg of Slipknot, Lizzie Hale, and members of the Metallica crew your very own questions,
and eligibility for our Metal Tales series where you can be a guest on Metal Up Your Podcast and tell us all about a notable Metallica show you've been to.
Subscribe to Patreon today and immediately get access to years worth of bonus content.
Thank you for supporting the people who make the things that you love. Peace.
Adios.
I can't talk about it anymore. It's giving me a headache.
Here, take two of these.
Ah, Nuprin. Little. Yellow. Different.
Okay, so I watched the documentary last night.
Yeah.
You saw it last week.
Yeah.
Now, I had trouble finding it. So here's the deal. It's on HBO Max, which I have.
Yeah, and but you couldn't find it?
Searching Woodstock 99 did not bring it up. So it's part of a series called The Music Box.
Ah, okay.
So it's a series of documentaries. So what I had to end up, I mean, I had to like Google, how do I find this fucking thing?
I had to watch 10 documentaries to get to it.
Exactly. So I did notice a really cool thing is that it's a series created by Bill Simmons.
Okay.
Who did 30 for 30.
Yeah, great.
He's a big sports guy, but a big basketball guy.
Yeah.
And I just read his book, The Book of Basketball.
Yeah.
It's like 1,000, it's a big book.
Yeah.
It's one of the most fun books I've ever read.
Cool.
Partly because I love basketball so much now.
Right.
But it was just so well written. So anyway, it's kind of a two worlds colliding thing. I'm like, oh, Bill Simmons created this series.
Awesome.
So this is the first in the music box. So you'll have to find it. It's on HBO Max. And you saw it last week. And it's causing a lot of interesting conversations in culture.
And that's kind of what we're going to do with this. So yeah, we're not watching anything. We're not, you know, we're just going to kind of discuss.
We're going to discuss it because I thought it was good. It was better than I thought it would be after reading a little bit about maybe what's a little controversial about it.
Sure.
And another really smart friend of mine the other night, my friend Josh, was curious with my thoughts about it. And he gave me his opinion. And,
okay.
You know, he's a very progressive, smart, liberal guy. And, you know, he had his takeaways. And it's, you know, there's definitely a cultural narrative of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what any documentary really is. I mean, documentaries aren't really just... here's the whole truth. Documentaries are like, here's a story about something that happened.
Yeah.
With a lean on what we think happened.
Right. Yeah. You can walk away with your own educated guess, but yeah, it's definitely geared towards, you know, convincing somebody.
Yeah.
Hey, this is, and I love documentaries. That's primarily what I watch, but yeah, it's, you know, most of them are not only educational, but hey, we're kind of pushing this idea on you in regards to this story.
Well, and I think too, you know, we're going to get into it, but Woodstock 99 was generally considered a kind of a disaster.
Yes.
And we're going to talk all about why. And I think what this documentary is trying to do is like make sense. Mm-hmm. It's trying to make sense of like what went wrong, you know, what worked about it, what didn't work, what can we learn? And so in those senses, I think it achieved its goal.
Yeah.
I thought it was well put together. It's like well edited.
Oh, yeah.
I do think it's missing a lot of like relevant voices.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be nice if Fred Durst was in it. It'd be nice if Anthony Kiedis was interviewed.
I wonder, I mean, surely those guys were probably asked, right?
Maybe. It's possible they were asked and they declined. It's possible they weren't asked. It's possible that what they had to say didn't fit the narrative of the documentary, and so they took it out.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know, but it is missing some key voices.
Yeah.
What you do have is you have the promoter, the two promoter guys,
yeah,
who they do try to make villains.
Yes.
And maybe they are. We're going to talk about that.
Right.
You have a lot of Moby, who I could not stand Moby in this.
Moby, yeah. I like Moby in general. I feel like, I guess his involvement in this was, I guess, maybe to be the contrast of what the festival was. And he was like, I don't fit in this. Maybe that was, I don't know. I'm just guessing.
He played the EDM tent one night.
Yeah.
He was not a player in this thing.
Right.
And so I don't know why he's so into it. And he just annoyed me to no end.
Okay.
Not that he didn't make some good salient points. And he's a smart guy. And, you know, I don't dislike him personally.
Right.
He just annoyed me in this. Interestingly, Dave Holmes is in it a lot. Do you remember Dave Holmes?
From MTV, yeah.
Looking pretty good.
Looking great.
Looking way better than he did 20 years ago.
Yeah, he looks awesome.
He famously won the, like, there was a contest. It only happened one year.
The VJ contest?
To be an MTV VJ. He did not win.
Right.
This guy named Jesse won.
Jesse.
Who looked like he was in Buck Cherry or something.
Yeah, and then he went missing for years.
He like flamed out. Like,
yeah.
He's actually in this Ottoman right now. Yeah. In HQ 1.
Oh, I should keep my feet on top of it then.
But I remember Dave Holmes was like the runner-up, but he was like so reliable, and he's been working in television ever since.
Ever since. I mean, and between those two guys, he, you know, Jesse was like the crazy, wacky guy that like, kind of he was on drugs. And,
right.
And then Dave Holmes was like kind of the clean cut.
The reliable guy.
Pretty straight-laced dude, yeah.
He could just read the copy and like actually interview stars without being on heroin or whatever it was. There's a couple of journalists in it that were interesting, but really not that many voices.
Yeah.
Jewel is in it.
Right.
They show a clip of Sheryl Crow that's not current. And then there's a little bit of Carson Daly, what sounds like a voiceover phone call.
Yeah, right.
Because MTV is going to factor into this story too.
Oh, yeah.
So anything I'm leaving out before we...
No, I mean, that's a great setup, man.
So I have some notes just about the festival itself, just to give some context. And then I just want to talk a little bit about what the documentary says. Now, we had talked about also watching Woodstock 99 on this episode, but I think we're just going to break this into parts.
Like the Metallica set or the whole documentary?
Oh, no, sorry, just the Metallica set.
We're going to rewatch the whole documentary.
Well, Woodstock 99, at least in my world, and I think for a lot of our listeners, is generally considered one of their most badass sets.
Right, yeah.
Now, when I was watching that as a kid, I didn't know about all this stuff going on.
Sure.
You know, in 1999, I was 16 years old. So I didn't do the pay-per-view version. We'll get into that. But MTV just covered it all weekend.
Yeah, I watched that like crazy.
And I remember the day that I most cared about was the East stage on Saturday, because it had Guster, Dave Matthews, Counting Crows, and then it ended with Metallica.
Yeah.
So like some of my favorite bands in 1999 were all of those bands.
Yeah.
And still are. I'm kind of having a little Guster renaissance
these days. Nice. I never gotten into them.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess that makes sense. They were never.
I mean, I can try.
I mean, maybe I'll make you a mixtape.
Hey, I wouldn't say no to it.
But that would be me giving you something I do have that you want, which would not be love.
I don't want to listen to Guster. Why would I listen to that?
There we go. We're fooling fate.
Yeah, see?
I don't have Guster, and you don't want it.
I've never heard of them.
So, I remember watching on MTV, but I didn't know, for example, that someone would go on to die who was at the Metallica show.
Yeah.
Someone died of hypothermia a couple of days later, was hospitalized, and then subsequently died.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know about the sexual assault.
I didn't know about any of this stuff
back then. I knew that, like, shit got burned.
That was, I mean, if you watched on MTV and their coverage with the Carson Daly,
you could see those fires out, you know.
For sure, yeah. I mean, and back then, I feel like that was definitely the what they were cool with getting out into the world. Like, nobody wanted to talk about the sexual assaults or the lack of water, dehydrations, and people rubbing shit on each other. You know, like, it was just, oh, things got out of hand and burned down and it turned into a riot.
Right.
And that was it, you know.
Which I got to say, I mean, we'll get into it. We'll get into it. So anyway, we talked about watching the set, but I think this is going to make more sense and be more digestible just talking about the documentary. And of course, we're going to talk about how Metallica fits into it.
Right.
There's a really strange Napster shoehorn in the documentary that really pissed me off.
That was literally the I remember I discussed this documentary with a few people on our Discord server, and that was one of the things I threw up there was like, what was the fucking point of that?
And I know you and I talked about it at the airport the other day, but I hadn't seen it yet. And you know what? Here we go again. Sorry for you Megadeth guys out there and guys and gals. But how about Mustaine being a total shitbag in it too?
For me, I remember back when I was in Metallica that we used to trade tapes. That's how we even discovered bands. I don't know. I can't blame Lars for doing the things that he does. Who knows why a guy does that? I mean, does he have enough money? Probably, right? I mean, my brain's going, don't say it, Dave, don't say it, Dave, don't say it, Dave. And you're going, say it, Dave, say it, Dave, say it, Dave.
And it wasn't like it was an old interview. It was for the documentary. You can tell
doesn't he have enough money? I'm like, you don't, well, first of all, you're either willfully ignorant about that, or you are being a cynical fuck.
I think he's being cynical.
It's like, we know he doesn't need the money, Dave. He wasn't doing it for the money. Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
Who wasn't a 19-year-old college kid at fucking Pepperdine downloading Until It Sleeps.
I just don't understand. Like, even though Metallica have never shit-talked him in the press, in the public, they've always reached out and been cool. The 30th anniversary shows, the Big Four shows, he's on stage. They're all hugging and having a great time. Lars talking backstage. And he still has this like permanent chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, he's a shithead. All right, so we're going to talk about all that. Let me break down a little bit of the festival. This won't take long, but these are just kind of just some details as you get in the lounge position, take a nappy nap. So this was in Rome, New York, which is still upstate New York, about 100 miles from the original site of Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
400,000 attendees in 4 days, because there was a pre-show on Thursday.
Right.
And then, of course, it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. 400,000 people.
It's a lot of people. A lot of peeps.
Pay-per-view covered it for $30 a day or $60 for the weekend, which that's a pretty good deal.
Dude, $60 is real cheap.
But you know what I'm curious about? This isn't mentioned in the documentary. A lot of MTV is mentioned. And MTV basically did coverage all weekend, which is how I watched it.
And they wouldn't show full sets.
They showed full sets. That's how I watched it.
I remember them showing like a couple songs at a time or something like that. Like they'd be doing other stuff and you could hear Metallica playing in the background or whatever. Because wouldn't that be weird if MTV was showing full sets for free? If you had cable, or you could pay $60.
Well, I think MTV was showing full sets of select bands.
Yeah, not
like,
everything.
Like, I think they showed the full Kid Rock set.
Right.
Like, I remember seeing Kid Rock set. I mean, this is before the internet, before I had access to, like, you know, we maybe had a family computer, like, in the den.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing Kid Rock full set, Dave Matthews full set, Metallica full set. Like, I think they just showed some throughout. It was mostly, like, coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would be like, and at 4 o'clock, is Dave Matthews.
Right, yeah.
I think they picked certain ones. Because I know I saw it in real time.
Yeah, for sure.
I do remember I was at a friend's house. Maybe he bought the pay-per-view. So I'm guessing the pay-per-view would have been just that static 2 or 3 camera.
Yeah, there was probably
well, with the audio.
Yeah, there was board mix or whatever. There was probably a camera in front of house. There's probably
two side cameras.
Ones, and then like a couple handhelds down below or something in the pit.
Well, at any rate, $60 for the whole weekend, I think, is a pretty good deal.
Great deal.
The site that they chose, and this is talked about in the documentary, which I do think is true. It's kind of like poetic irony. An abandoned Air Force base, you know, the big peace festival at a military base. And they wanted to avoid the gate crashing that happened in 94 and in 69. So this basically had a reinforced wall around it. And so, you know, we're going to talk a lot about the sort of corporate greed. The real villain, I think, of the festival was corporate greed.
Yes.
So the dudes who created it, which was the original promoter from the original Woodstock.
Yeah, for sure. He doesn't look that much different either.
Yeah.
He still has the same haircut. Yeah. So he has like a baby face.
I wonder if that's going to happen to me. I guess it's already not happened to me.
Well, I mean, I'm 68. I look pretty good.
But I guess they were just like, hey, we like the idea that people can't gate crash. You know, people are going to have to buy tickets.
Yeah.
Which, you know, there's also a subtext of it too, where it's like, well, what are we going to do? Blame him for wanting to make money? Like, welcome to America.
Yeah. I mean, well, and you, I mean, it's like those festivals obviously cost a shitload of money to put on. When you're having bands as big as Rage Against the Machine and Metallica at the time.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want people coming in for free. You sold tickets. You got to pay for it.
Right.
I don't get the sense that he's like trying to get rich.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about it too. I was talking to my friend Josh, who'd already watched it. And I was like, I wonder, because they don't talk about this either. I wonder if it made money. Because think about paying all those bands.
It's a lot, dude. I mean, you and I play a lot of festivals. I've played a lot of those big ones in Europe and stuff like that. And it's like, I mean, there's shows where it's like you'll have 3 or 4 massive bands headlining each
night.
So
this might actually explain some of that. So there were a lot of corporate sponsors. There were vendor malls. There were ATMs. Tickets were $150 plus service fees, which came out to around $200, which was pretty expensive for the time.
Yeah.
I mean, Dude, we bought tickets to the 40th anniversary shows. That shit was not cheap.
That's not cheap, right?
Plus all the travel. I mean,
yeah.
Shoot, dude. When Blazik offered me the Snake Pit, so the deal with the Snake Pit pass that he offered me is I had to have a ticket to get the Snake Pit. The Snake Pit wasn't a ticket,
right? Right.
So I just bought the cheapest seat there was for Detroit, or no, for St. Louis. Right? And that ticket was like $140.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, concerts aren't, I mean, I've even gone through, I've got a little photo book that I put old ticket stubs in years ago. It's real cute.
That is cute.
It is rad, though, to look in there and see like two different tickets that are Rage Against the Machine.
You know, man.
Like,
yeah.
You know, Chili Peppers in like 98 or whatever.
Yep.
But to see some of the prices, it was like Rage Against the Machine, it was like
$18. I remember seeing Dave Matthews in 1999 at Lakewood Amphitheater in Atlanta. And I got, they called their fan base The Warehouse. They have a song called Warehouse.
Yeah.
And it was $50. And I remember in 1999, I was a junior in high school, maybe. I was like, fuck. I mean, it was like within my reach, but hard. I mean,
but that's a lot of money when you're in high school. You know, if you maybe have a job already or something, like I worked at a coffee shop.
Right.
No, I'm sorry. In high school, my first job was Blockbuster Video.
Wow. You worked in a Blockbuster.
Oh, yeah. I wore khakis in that blue shirt.
Wow.
Wow. I always loved every day when people were like, hey, you have any copies of this movie back there? Whatever new release at the time.
Yeah.
I was like, no, we don't. Like, can you check the bin? I'm like, oh, you motherfucker.
Check the bin. Like, oh, because people put the tapes in the return bin.
Yeah. And then if we weren't busy, I'm like, okay. And then I go over there and they're like over your shoulder looking. And all of a sudden, there it is right there. I'm like, oh my God.
Mortal Kombat. It's right there.
Yeah, totally.
1995 is Mortal Kombat. All right. Now, here's some of the environmental problems, right, with the festival. No shade.
Mm-hmm.
They're on concrete. Because it's a military base.
Right.
Around 100 degrees or more.
It's crazy.
The east and west stages were almost 2.5 miles apart. So when you're, let's say you make your itinerary for all the 15 bands you want to see.
Yeah.
Which these are all the biggest bands in the 90s or the 1999, biggest bands of that year for sure. Then you're making that walk on the asphalt.
It's a long walk.
Back and forth multiple times. What I found really interesting about the documentary was people when they would get lost. So this is pre-cell phone, or this is pre the ubiquity of cell phones.
Right.
So let's say me and you were there having a good time, and next thing you know, where's Clint?
Or I'm like, hey, dude, I'm going to go run and grab a slice of pizza.
So they had basically a big missing person area where you could just go there and hope your buddies showed up, or you could leave notes on like an actual forum, an actual bulletin board.
Yeah.
And just think, I mean, the one guy talks about getting lost from his buddy for like a day, a whole day, gone.
And and you don't know if they're going to like come back, make it back to camp, or are they fucked up on LSD somewhere or what, you know, like.
I mean, I'm trying to remember. I'm like, well, what did I do? Because I was going to concerts and shit. And I remember this. This is what you did. You had a plan for if you got lost.
Yeah.
You would always say, if we get lost, we're going to meet here at the car or whatever.
Yeah, after the show. Yeah, for sure.
But I never went to a festival where I got lost.
I never went
for days.
I never went to any festivals until I started playing them. And at that point, if you get lost, you're a dummy because you're usually backstage on a bus or in a van.
If you get lost at a festival you're playing at,
yeah,
then something's wrong.
If you get lost behind the stage you're playing.
I just found that fascinating about the documentary. There's like the footage of it of just like, there's like people like at payphones trying to like, figure out shit, you know?
It's crazy.
Not enough room in the grassy area to accommodate the campers, not enough toilets or showers. By, I think, the morning of day two, they were overflowing and unusable.
Even like the shower areas were like, people were standing in mud and shit.
And, you know, they were all kind of separated by these little tarps and stuff. And like, you know, there's a couple of the ladies that are featured that are like, we didn't really feel safe in there. Like they were just separated from the men's showers by tarps. And some of these fucking perverts were like, trying to look over.
Yeah.
And so, stupid. You've got a lot of people that are just, you know, opting not to bathe.
Right. But I would have been that one of those people.
But here's the deal. You can opt not to bathe, but you got to shit somewhere.
Yes.
So
at some point you have to.
You know, I think the big theme for me in the problems that I see that I don't think the documentary was that fair about. I think the documentary had a different narrative. But I think really is when you put a bunch of people in heat without water, and when they can't use the bathroom, you're going to get violence.
Yes,
you know,
yeah, absolutely. Especially when the waters, the ones they did have there were crazy expensive.
So the waters were $4, which at the time I guess was super expensive.
Yeah.
Now they did have free water. They had these fountains.
Yeah.
I guess the deal with that was at some point these idiots started like bathing themselves in the fountains.
Yeah.
Now, which again is a ripple effect problem of the showers weren't working.
Right.
So then you got these guys. There's like one video of this chick in the fountain where you're supposed to be able to like dunk your head, brush your teeth, get water for your water bottle.
Yeah.
But then you got people fucking with their shampoo and like jumping in it. And you're like, and then they got to a point where they like busted one of the pipes.
Because the water in there was like too filthy. And yeah, people busted the pipes open. And then what does that create? A big ass muddy mess.
Mud, right. And then when the porta potties were overflowing, that mud is being mixed up with shit.
Yeah.
And people are fucking sliding around in it, thinking they're living some sort of hippie dream.
Have fun always.
And they're trying to have fun always. And turns out they're having fun never.
Yeah.
Because they're in human shit. And again, these are all like cascading infrastructure social problems,
right,
that start with no access to hydration and no access to like sanitary cleanliness for going to the bathroom or for taking a shower.
Yeah.
I think if you take 400,000 people, any kind of people, and put them in that situation, you're going to get some dicey shit.
Things are going to go wrong for sure.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Let alone 22 young little white knuckleheads that are Limp Bizkit fans.
Yeah.
That are, you know, and that's the message of the film is that these young white guys really blew the whole thing.
Obviously, there's an element of that, of course.
For sure. I mean,
you have dudes that probably are just from suburban neighborhoods that are in a, you know, middle to upper class white family that they don't really have the opportunity to rage in front of mom and dad. But hey, we're going to go to Woodstock and all these bands are playing.
Rage against math class.
Right.
Rage against algebra. Although
algebra.
My favorite, you know, do you remember the club Smith's Old Bar in Atlanta?
No, never heard of it.
You never played Smith's Old Bar?
No.
It's maybe a 300 cap. It's kind of a famous little club there. But they have a green room that's known as the poop green room, where it's filled with everyone writing band names, but with the pun of it somehow it being poop.
Okay.
Or something dealing with like shit, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I have a submission in there that I think as good as any.
Okay.
Rage Against the Latrines.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's good.
I was pretty proud of that.
That's really good.
Anyway. What were you saying about? Oh, you were saying that these guys don't have an opportunity in their suburban, like
sort of
middle class lives to have a you know, an anger catharsis.
Right. Yeah. I think that, you know, that kind of music in that era, the late 90s when rap rock was getting really popular, with obviously bands like Limp Bizkit.
Yeah.
I feel like these guys like this didn't really have a reason to get angry and rage, quote unquote, but put in this situation we're describing. Now they have one, you know what I mean? Like you don't have water. The conditions are just literally shitty.
And my point is like, yeah, I think that you put anyone there, they're gonna be mad.
Anybody. It didn't have to be early 20s white dudes.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. And I get it. Like people really want to look at something like what didn't work about Woodstock or what was violent about it, or what was scary about it. Especially the irony of it being a peace, you know, peace and love.
Right.
And I think people want to be able to say, this simple thing is the reason. People want to be able to just like deduce it to something.
It's Fred Durst.
And let's face it, like this cultural moment we are in now, people are tired of white guys.
Yeah.
Including me. No problem.
Sure.
I get it. White privilege is definitely on display in the marketplace of ideas more than ever in a critical light.
Yeah.
And I think that's a conversation worth having. I'm not afraid of it as a white guy.
Sure.
I think what it means is that we're moving towards, you know, more equity in society.
Yeah.
And I'm for that. I support that.
Same. I'm with you.
But I do think that the documentary is seen through the lens of this moment to where they're saying, oh, well, it's just white rage. And I just don't think that's the case.
Yeah.
I think it's part of it.
It definitely doesn't help it. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't help what happened.
But, you know, the film ends by basically championing Coachella. And by saying basically Coachella was the answer to Woodstock, which Coachella's first year, 1999.
I know. It's crazy, right?
And so I think it's a big tell in the documentary where it's like, well, where's all the white rage at Coachella?
Yeah.
And you know where it is? It's that they gave everybody a water bottle.
Yeah. That was one thing I was discussing with a few people on Discord was that having been to hundreds of festivals in my touring life, I think that water should be free. No matter what, and not just a fountain
right.
that someone could eventually jump into.
Right.
I'm talking like if you're drawing 400,000 people, there should be 2 million bottles of water there to give to people when they need it.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree. Or make it super affordable. Like, I get it. You gotta, nothing's free in life.
Of course.
So, I don't know. Maybe make it $1. I don't know. I mean, have a corporate sponsor just take care of the water. There's so many ways to deal with it.
Right.
But what they wanted, I mean, dude, and this is why the corporate greed is the villain, not that dumbass promoter, not white kids, not Fred Durst. Because I think if you're going to blame Fred Durst, you better fucking equally be blaming Rage Against the Machine, because killing in the name of is going to make that same little 22-year-old. I don't think Metallica has the songs that are like call to arms. Like, right. Killing in the Name of is like a calls to arm. It's fuck you, I won't do what you tell me 16 times.
Yeah, yeah. Break Stuff.
And Break Stuff is basically saying be angry, be mad,
right.
fuck authority, fuck your parents. Metallica doesn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I think I would wager that Metallica's music transcends those calls to arms.
You're right.
But Killing the Name of is a call to arms.
Yeah.
Some of those who work forces are the same that burn crosses. Boom. It's like, fuck you, I will not do what you tell me.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, everybody, stop tearing down the scaffolding.
Right, right.
Well, you got Zach De La Rocha saying, well, fuck you, I won't do what you tell me.
Yeah.
And they didn't go after Rage. Fred Durst is an easy target, dude.
Yeah, he's an easy target for sure.
And you know, they've got the promoters in his ear saying, hey, man, tone it down. There's a Les Claypool quote. Les Claypool?
Les Claypool.
There's a Les Claypool quote. Am I still saying his name wrong?
Les Claypool.
Okay. Where he's like, you know, Fred Durst was being Fred Durst. That's what they hired him to do.
Yeah.
They didn't hire him to incite a riot. But if you go and be like, hey, Fred Durst, can you be Mary Poppins for a minute? Because the kids are going crazy.
Like, that's not what I do.
He's not going to do that.
Right.
You booked him.
How do you feel about, because I'm kind of on the fence with this.
Okay.
Being a Chili Peps fan.
Yeah. Put the abbreviation on Peps.
Somebody's got to. When the promoter basically went over to Anthony Kiedis at some point and said, hey, could you help us try to calm this crowd down?
I think he should have done more.
You think he should have, instead of them calling an audible and playing the song Fire?
Well.
Which is a great cover, by the way.
He, in his book, Scar Tissue, he claims that he was asked to play that song by Jimi Hendrix's daughter.
Ah, okay.
As an homage to the, obviously, to the original Woodstock and to Jimmy.
I didn't read that book, by the way.
Now, is that true? I don't know. Did them coming out playing Light My Fire instigate, did that pour some gasoline, no pun intended, on the sitch?
Right.
Yeah, it did. But I'll say this too. My friend Josh was asking me about this, and this speaks to your experience at hundreds of festivals. Same for me. I played hundreds of these. Sometimes when you are, now I've never seen Pillars of Flame.
Yeah.
I've never seen that. But sometimes when you're on stage, you can't really tell what's happening.
No, oh no.
You can see that there's movement. You can see, I've seen like fights or I've seen scuffles.
Yeah.
But I have been told after some shows that even I've played that some shit has gone down.
Yeah.
That I couldn't see. And I couldn't, what am I going to do? Or you look at Pearl Jam at the Roskilde Festival.
Yeah.
Where they're just playing Pearl Jam songs. You know, they're not playing Break Stuff.
Right.
They're just playing Don't Call Me Daughter and shit. And 9 people died.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know?
And a lot of times in those cases, as the artist on stage, you're in the moment. You may not be looking right down at the barricade. You might be just looking across the sea of people. Most of the time, the artist isn't finding out about this stuff until they walk off stage.
But I think if you have someone coming to you and saying, hey, like people are burning shit and like they are going to listen to you, I do think you can de-escalate.
I
think Fred Durst could have de-escalated.
I think so.
I just think that's almost like asking, but that's just asking him not to be who he is.
Well, the Chili Peppers are more, you know, they're not that band that's like the Break Stuff band.
No, they're kind of hippie funk shit.
Exactly. That's where I feel like maybe, you know, was it his fault? No. As far as like what broke out?
You know, he's quoted as saying, the fires out there look beautiful. It looks like apocalypse now.
Yeah.
I think that's because he didn't realize the extent of how dangerous it was.
Right. I mean, from the stage, I mean, those things were at the very back. From your perspective on stage, it might just be like, oh, wow, like a bonfire.
But then you have the guy telling him, like, hey, man.
It's getting gnarly out there.
I mean, I've heard bootlegs of Eddie Vedder doing that, like stopping a song and being like, hey, being like the security guard was beating up on a kid.
Oh, yeah. I've seen a bunch of those.
Kurt Cobain has done that, too. And that's obviously different. It's not scaled out this big. It's a big mess. I do think that they could have de-escalated. But, you know, it's like you can ask a bunch of these guys not to grope these women, but they're going to do it because the world is the world.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make it right, and it's not their fault. I am not saying anything like that. But you're asking Fred Durst to de-escalate. That'd be great.
I feel like if someone like Fred Durst, because that's who he is, if someone like Fred Durst tried to de-escalate, I think it might have, could, or let me ask this, could it have made it worse? Wait, the guy that was, sings about breaking stuff wants me to calm down?
Right.
Fuck that.
Right.
Fuck you and do what you tell me.
There was some energy too that, that there were some things like he said from stage that weren't really in the documentary where, and I know what he's trying to do, but I don't think it works, where he's like, I want you to take all your pain and rage. And he was basically saying, I want you to get it out, like to exercise it so you'll feel better.
Yeah.
Not get it out, like tear everything down. Of course, the song is called Break Stuff.
Right.
It's kind of just a perfect storm of bullshit.
Yeah, for sure.
Again, I think if you've got a bunch of people that aren't, you know, walking on shit and piss all day and spending all of their money on water that they can't afford and nowhere to eat or bathe.
Right.
I think if you have them play Break Stuff at Coachella, you don't have these problems.
Right.
Which is kind of my thesis of this whole thing.
For sure.
This is what Durst said. He said later in an interview, I didn't see anybody getting hurt. You don't see that when you're looking out and see if people on the stage is 20 feet in the air and you're performing and you're feeling your music. How do they expect us to see something bad going on?
Which there's some truth to that. You know, when you're up there,
yeah,
it's unless you're literally playing and just like staring right. And really, after about 200, 300 people back, it really is a blur.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest show I've ever played was downtown Nashville for Kings of Leon, the New Year's Eve set. And it was like 150,000 people.
Yeah.
I remember doing another one in Mexico City. It was like 90,000. And it literally is, it's surreal. You cannot tell. I mean, if somebody, 1,000 people back, was even above the crowd with a gun to someone's head, you couldn't tell. It's so hard to tell.
But it's also, I just think there, yeah, exactly. I agree with all that. But then also, I mean, unless you guys have been in this position, you just don't know, but like, it's hard to know what to do even when they tell you, hey, something weird has happened and you have to go play a song. I was doing a Bob Schneider show. They do a thing in Austin called Live on the Green. It's the biggest show I've ever played with him. It's like 40,000 people.
Wow.
It's like a festival type thing. Like Gary Clark Jr. had played. And
same name as the one we have here.
Yeah, it's called Live on the Green.
Oh, crazy.
It's because it's a big green field in the city.
Yeah.
It's called Blues on the Green.
Blues on the Green, okay.
But it's not just blues artists. Like Bob played it.
Jazz Fest isn't all jazz artists.
Yeah, Spoon played it and shit.
Yeah.
So we're headlining it. And, you know, Austin is like Bob's town, dude. Everyone there loves him.
Yeah.
It was like pretty rowdy, not like metal, not break stuff, but, you know, his shit's kind of dancey and fun and irreverent. And during our encore break, we were told that a parent had their 5-year old, they lost their 5-year old.
Oh, wow.
In the crowd. 5-year old's real young, real delicate.
Yeah.
You know, you lose your 10-year old. All right. That's not good, but 5-year old's like that, something really.
It's a kindergartner.
And it was a little girl. And so. A lot of different implications about the safety of that kid.
Sure.
And so, but we had two songs to play that were like our rowdiest songs.
Yeah.
So we went out, we made an announcement that was like, hey, there's a kid missing, a 5-year little girl. Her name is blah, blah, blah. She looks like this. We need to find her.
Yeah.
Mom's going to be over at the tent at the thing. And then you know what we had to do? Play that fucking song. And I wanted to throw up those two songs.
Did the crowd immediately just go crazy for the song?
Yeah.
Rather than.
Well, I mean, not crazy like breaking things, but yeah, I mean, dancing and like it was harder in that moment probably to find a kid than it was if we'd have said everyone in the crowd moved 5 feet away from each other or something.
Right, right.
The when Roskilde happened with Pearl Jam, when he heard that people were on the ground being trampled, I thought this was genius of Eddie Vedder in that moment. He was like, stopped everything. He said, on the count of three, I want everyone to take 3 steps back.
Yeah.
And he did it, counted to three, and the whole crowd moved back about 10 feet.
Yeah.
And they were just bodies.
Oh.
You know?
So awful.
So I'm up there, and I think we had just had Nova. This was like fall of 2014.
Yeah.
We had Nova summer in 2014. By we, I mean my wife.
Right.
I had nothing to do with it.
You do half the work, Clint.
I was, you know, it was exhausting staying up for 17 hours waiting for her to give birth. That was
a joke, by the way. Women get all the credit for pushing a human out of their bodies.
And that's the joke we're making.
Of course.
Hopefully our audience is hip to nuance about that. Okay. So anyway, we had to play those songs. And the whole time I'm just thinking, what if this kid's hurt? What if someone took her, you know?
What if she gets trampled or whatever, you know?
And you know, the good news is we found out after the show that everything was cool. But I'm just saying, in those moments, it's hard to know what to do.
Yeah. I mean, props to guys like Eddie Vedder that will literally stop a show. Like at that point, he doesn't give a fuck if you're watching Pearl Jam. It's like, we want these people to be safe.
Well, I think he'd been told that we got people down.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So that was Saturday. And Metallica headlined that night.
Yeah.
And as I said in the documentary, they talk about a guy got hypothermia in the crowd and ended up, he ended up dying because they didn't treat him for hypothermia. They treated him for like drug overdose.
Yeah. Was this the dude's buddy?
Yeah.
It was like his first show ever or something, or first Metallica show ever.
It's a really effective part of the documentary where he had a journal. And so every day he's journaling, and a lot of his journal entries were about how much he was looking forward to Metallica.
Yeah.
Because it was his favorite band.
Right.
He's like, all I want to do is get in the pit for Metallica and be on MTV or whatever it was.
Right.
And they got separated from Metallica that night because his buddies, and I've been in this position before in a festival, his buddies were like, hey man, I'm out. I can't do this. I can't hang.
That's how it was when I first saw Rage Against the Machine. I had to get out of there. And I had a girlfriend with me, a friend that is a girl. And she was like super freaked out because we were right next to the big ass circle pit. And it was like, it was gnarly.
I mean, this is going to sound lame. I think I've told the story before on the show. But for me, the scariest I've ever been was at an Oasis concert.
Oh, wow.
We waited all day and we were basically equivalent of fifth row. And this was in 1999 or 2000. Yeah. And I mean, they were at one of the heights of their things. And the crowd was just, I had no control over what was, I was just moving like a sea with the crowd.
Yeah.
Lost my shoes because I was wearing Birkenstocks. Birkenstocks gone. Like I'm on the MARTA later trying to get home with no shoes.
Amazing.
Like one of the grossest subways ever.
Let me ask you this. Birkenstocks with socks?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that's what we did. And not the Birkenstocks with like the Birkenstocks that were just like a big shell.
Yeah.
Not the ones with like clasps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you remember those? Did you ever have those?
My grandma bought me Birkenstocks for Christmas one year, and I was I had to swallow my pride and say thank you because I was not down with Birkenstocks. Because I was into like punk rock. I was wearing Converse, and it was like, she bought me Birkenstocks, bless her, but God rest her soul.
Right.
Because they were very popular, and she thought, I'm sure my grandson will like this.
Wow.
I didn't.
Well, I mean, I couldn't even move my arms up. Like, there was a guy crowd surfing wearing Doc Martens, and I could tell by the way he was moving that he was going to hit me in the face with his shoes.
Yeah.
I couldn't even bring my arms up to cover my face. So I just, like, getting hit in the face.
Oh, God.
And, dude, I looked at my buddy, and I was like, I have to get out of here. I want to die in here.
It's gnarly, man. I won't ever get in a crowd like that ever again.
So his buddy split, and then they just didn't hear from him for a day. And they ended up finding out later that, you know, he was at some point picked up by a paramedic.
Yeah.
His temperature had gone up to 107.
That's insane.
And when that happens, you feel cold.
Yeah.
His mother ended up suing the promoters.
Yeah.
And I think some of the doctors that were involved because they treated him and they were just overwhelmed with dehydrated and kids. And like one of the EMTs in the documentary actually says that like 80% of the cases they treated were from dehydration.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's just tragic. I mean,
I've never been that dehydrated in my life.
Where you almost died of it?
Well, or to where I think I, you know, maybe need medical attention.
Right, right.
I drink a lot of water and all that stuff. Even days where I don't, like, I don't ever feel any effects of mild dehydration.
Well, another thing that they talk about in the documentary that I think is also true is, you know, when the water is as expensive as the beer, these kids are going to buy the beer.
Yeah.
So they're just further.
Well, I'm going to get drunk over than, like, I'm going to stay hydrated. No, I'm going to get drunk with my friends on Miller Lite.
Which is further dehydrating them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely is.
So, okay. So that was Saturday. Sunday, which is the day that the burnings happened and shit, there was an anti-gun violence nonprofit there that was passing out candles to do a vigil for Columbine, which is awesome.
Great intent.
But obviously, in hindsight, giving all of these people, you know, access to fire after everything they'd been through that weekend, probably not a great idea. So during the Chili Peppers set, fires were, they were making the fires out of like the garbage cans and like the plywood from some of the walls and stuff and scaffolding. But then they actually even burnt down one of the audio towers.
Oh, yeah.
Which is pretty scary. Like there's actual footage of it falling, and that would have definitely killed someone if it fell on them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Big ass audio tower.
Oh, yeah. All that scaffolding is not, it's not lightweight.
And then this is when it kind of did turn more into a riot. The ATMs were actually ripped apart. The vendors like booths and merch just stolen.
Oh yeah.
And you know, there's just the actual footage of people just stealing shit,
burning the semi trucks, like just gnarly.
Kurt Loder says it was dangerous to be around. The whole scene was scary. There were waves of hatred bouncing around the place. It was clear we had to get out of there. He says it was like a concentration camp. To get in, you get frisked to make sure you're not bringing in any water or food that would prevent you from buying their outrageously priced booths. You wallow around in garbage and human waste. He said there was a palpable mood of anger. State troopers eventually arrived. There's pretty harrowing audio of, I guess, some of the police, some of the state troopers basically saying, if this crowd decides to move on us, we're fucked.
Yeah.
Like if they basically decide, you know, it was mostly fucking idiots just banging on trash cans thinking they were part of some hippie, you know, counterculture revolution, yeah, a movement. But you got people stealing shit. And then, you know, in the middle of all that, you have all of these nightmarish accounts of sexual assault.
I know.
Some women who, you know, were raped and...
Yeah, it was one account of, you know, a woman being raped in, like, the tent area and
screaming and no one helping her.
Not one person helping her.
Which I just don't even understand it.
There's been times where I've been, like, sitting in my backyard and I think I hear, like, a random scream and I immediately stand up. I'm like, mm-hmm. What the fuck was that?
Mm-hmm.
If I hear it again, I need to try to figure out where this is. But, like, it's just that it makes me so sad and so pissed off that this poor woman went there to have fun.
Yeah.
And that happens to her and does whatever she can to get someone to help her, to save her. And I'm sure people walked by the tent and heard screaming and didn't do anything.
And, you know, there's just a fucking problem in human society with how we treat women, how we see mm-hmm. women. Do I want my daughter walking around a concert naked? No. But, you know, the idea that, oh, because she was naked around me, I can grab her or objectify or assault her is just absolutely fucking disgusting.
Yeah.
And I wish they could all be held accountable for it. And, you know, I hope there were people out in the crowd giving those guys a hard time. I mean, I like what Dexter Friebisch said, you know, the Offspring guy.
Oh, Dexter Holland, yeah.
Or Dexter Holland, sorry. Dexter Friebisch, Jesus.
I was going to bring this up, but right before you jump into this, I was going to say this earlier. I don't know if this was just editing or whatever. According to the documentary, he was the only person that said something from stage about assault.
Hmm.
Only person.
You mean only person? They didn't say that in the documentary. They just, that's all they show.
That's all they show. Now, I would like to think that there'd be people on stage saying like, hey, like, because it was happening left and right. I mean, there's way more, probably too much footage of that in the documentary,
right,
in my opinion.
Right.
But Dexter Holland's the only one on stage that they show saying, like, stopping and saying, hey, like, that's bullshit.
We've talked to our friend Jean Froman before about Woodstock 99. I think it was you who talked to her. I'd like to get her back on, you know, in light of this documentary. Obviously, a female's perspective,
sure,
we value, and, you know, I could be wrong about all this. But it is sad if he's the only one who said something. I mean, I would have said something for sure. And what he said was, like, I thought he did a pretty good job of, you know, there's just so much psychology in how you're going to try to tell a crowd that big to do something.
Yeah.
Like, there's a really delicate balance of, like, being preachy and saying it in a way that would instigate more of it.
Yes.
And I thought he did a good job. He came off kind of like, look, we're here to have a good time.
Yeah.
And he's like, listen, man, just because some chick's wanting to, like, crowd surf does not mean you should grab her.
Yeah.
He's like, so stop doing it. And if you see someone doing it, what did he say? He's like, kick their ass. And then he was like, and if you see a guy going across, grab his fucking balls.
Yeah.
And I think he did it in a way that kind of got people on his side.
Yeah, for sure.
And who knows how effective it was. I mean, my opinion about the world, Ethan,
yes,
is that the world is the world.
Mm-hmm.
And there will always be people who, I don't know what to call it. I don't know if it's evil. I don't know if it's, they're so damaged. I don't know where to put it, but there will always be people who are looking to take advantage of the situation.
Yeah, it sucks.
I don't know what's going on in their brains when they basically say, well, I'm in a big crowded place. I can get away with just sexually assaulting women at, you know, with impunity. There are always going to be those people, man.
Yeah.
There's always going to be people who, when there's chaos around, they want to smash a window and take a thing.
Yeah.
Like some of these other people did when they started taking merch. I'm like, what are you going to do? You're going to steal a bunch of merch at an Air Force base and carry a bunch of corn hats
and then you
to
got
the
a bunch
parking
of
lot?
Woodstock t-shirts?
What is it?
Yeah, and I, you know, in regards to the sexual assault thing of the festival, I would like to believe that there were people in the crowd that weren't standing for that shit. You know, for the cases that did happen, it's fucking awful.
They do interview people that are like disgusted by stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like not only the sexual assault stuff, which is by far the worst part of it, you know.
Of course.
But also the people like vandalizing the wall, the peace wall.
Mm-hmm.
They basically painted a mural.
Right.
Because they understood the irony of the symbology of like peace, but it's a wall, but we love peace, but we just can't have everybody coming in. This is also a product we're selling.
Yeah.
All of those like ideas just got confused. And I actually think it was Jewel who ended up saying, surprisingly to me, because she doesn't make sense in a lot of interviews I see of her, but she actually made some sense where she was like, we didn't really have anything to believe in or fight against or for. So right. There was almost this vacuum. Like Woodstock had the Vietnam War and shit.
Yeah,
and like,
for sure.
The late 90s was like kind of a vacuum of that.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have like, they're mad at corporate greed. Okay. The film tries to make a case that like they're mad at MTV because MTV started playing boy bands.
Right.
Which I thought was pretty tenuous.
It's weird. It's definitely weird. Like
They're mad at Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. They try to make that. They try to make it like culture was just like nihilist. Like you got Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. You've got Kid Rock being homophobic and misogynist.
Yeah.
There's some of those parts of it that felt really, really shoehorned.
Yeah, for sure.
Like they like showed Kid Rock like grabbing his crotch and saying, suck my dick.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, this is white rage, misogyny, and homophobia.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, he learned it from Dr. Dre.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the first suck my dick I ever heard was on The Chronic.
Yeah.
You know, I learned that from Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
And obviously so did Kid Rock. It's like, it just seemed like there was some emphasis put in certain areas and not in others to bulwark a narrative.
Yeah, they definitely were trying to shape a narrative for sure.
So it's just tough, you know.
Without endorsing Kid Rock, by the way, just so you know. I don't like
for Kid sure Rock. Not endorsing Kid Rock.
No.
This is what Tom Morello had to say, right? Tom Morello, guitar player for Rage Against the Machine, on talking about like the blame being laid at the kids, at the attendees of the festival.
Right.
He says, hey, man.
Hey, man.
He does say this. Hey, man, leave the kids alone. He says, I've had enough of the frenzied demonization of young people surrounding Woodstock 99. Yes, Woodstock was filled with predators, the degenerate idiots who assaulted those women, the greedy promoters who wrung every cent out of thirsty concert goers, and last but not least, the predator media that turned a blind eye to real violence and scapegoated the 250,000 music fans at Woodstock 99, the vast majority of whom had the time of their lives. Now, curiously, he's not in the film.
Yeah.
You know, because that's a pretty scathing indictment, you know?
I would imagine at this point, if the documentary came out, Tom Morello would probably have publicly said something like, hey, I was interviewed for it, but they didn't use it.
Yeah.
Because they didn't like what I said or something like that.
Yeah.
Or maybe he declined it. Maybe, I mean, he's a smart dude. Maybe he got approached about it and he was like, okay, well, I want to know what the documentary is going to be about. Like, what's the narrative you're pushing? What are you wanting to shed a light on?
Or maybe he's just smart and like, you know, you and I had a conversation before we had this conversation on the podcast about, do we even have this talk about this? Because, you know, it touches on issues of race. It touches on issues of gender. It touches on a lot of cultural conversations being had now, where you can get in a lot of trouble for just asking questions or having a difference of opinion.
Right.
And maybe he's smart enough to know, like, I don't want to deal with it. You know, it's obviously going to be slanted towards this certain thing. And maybe my opinion is going to go against that. And I just don't want to deal with the fallout of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think about all the festivals I've been to and how well they're organized and how well they've gone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's stuff that happens. And like I said, you know, I've seen a girl crowd surf and I've seen hands go up and grab them.
Mm-hmm.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
Always. Always will be.
Big time.
But it's very rare that a festival of this size ends like this.
Yeah.
And so, I think it is kind of a tough question to ask. Who's to blame? I think it's a lot of areas, you know? I don't know. There's just so many that have gone off really well without a hitch and stuff like that, you know? And it's like, yeah, people are making a ton of money doing this thing and things are expensive and stuff like that. But this one, I don't know. It was just like the perfect ingredients were put in this confined space and mix those all together and you get just disaster.
I think that's probably true. I think that, but I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Okay.
But I do think that's probably true. How much did MTV playing Britney Spears have to do with people like, you know, raping someone at Woodstock?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
How much did Bill Clinton's heinous steamrolling of Monica Lewinsky for his own political gain affect how people saw women at the festival? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
All you know, we're talking about all these things, right? Suburban white males who, you know, they play that scene from Fight Club,
right?
The Chuck Palahniuk novel, David Fincher film, where he's like, we were all told we'd be celebrities, and now we're finding out we're not, and we're mad, and we're in Fight Club.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I do think there's an argument that against the idea that many of these things came together. And I think it might be as simple as the infrastructure could not support the amount of people that were there.
Right.
In that heat.
Yeah.
You know, I find it hard to believe that you could take 400,000 of a lot of different kinds of people and put them in that kind of environmental duress mm-hmm. and not expect anger and violence.
Sure, of course. Like, I wonder, you know, in hindsight, if it was the whole weekend was, you know, 75 degrees and they had no problem with water.
Right, exactly.
And they had no problem with toilets and showers. Just those like four or five things.
Yeah.
If that was different, would it have been a whole different ball game? Probably.
I don't think you're going to have a riot.
Right.
I mean, I wonder if there's some studies about this, but I got to imagine that there's sexual assault at a lot of concerts.
Yeah.
And I mean, I hate it, you know?
Of course.
I wish we lived in a world where that weren't the case, but we live in the world, dude.
Yeah. It sucks. It totally sucks, you know? And I hate that, you know, specifically happening at like a show or a festival or something like that, because it's like, nobody goes to a show to be like, I'm going to go there and have a terrible time. That's what live music is. You're going to go have a great time.
Right.
With your friends or by yourself or whatever, seeing your favorite band, going to a festival, all that stuff. And to know that that happens on a regular basis and just like not only ruining the experience of the show is the least of the concern
sure.
at that point.
I mean, those are traumatizing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't go there for your buddy to die. Just because he wanted to see Metallica.
Yeah.
You don't go there for your sister to get fucking groped by some dickhead during a Korn set, or to hear that your girlfriend, you know, got all her clothes torn off in the mosh pit.
Yeah.
Or, you know, to swim in shit for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that the documentary is attempting to explain this thing that happened.
Yeah.
And I like that I thought about the conversation you and I had at the airport and I hadn't seen it yet. And I had a similar conversation with my friend Josh 2 nights ago. I do like that it is stoking conversation.
Yeah,
I think the conversation is really important.
Oh, no, the conversation should actually happen.
It's interesting. It's an interesting documentary. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I saw it. I'm glad it was made.
I kind of want to I'm talking about it with you for the last X amount of minutes or whatever it was, I'm curious to actually watch it again. Because I feel like I came out of it differently than you. Not 100%, but just on a couple things. So I'd be interested to maybe, you know, within the next few months, like burn it down again and see how I feel. I mean, I'm not going to, a lot of things aren't going to change. Obviously, like the fucked up part about a lot of it is not going to change, but I
know what it's going to do. It's just going to make you a Korn fan. Well, listen, write in, let us know what you think. I mean, you know, we're having a conversation.
Yeah,
we're having an open-ended conversation.
It's very important.
And I'm fully aware that I am weighing in on the racial implications and the implications about the females. As a white guy and with a very limited privileged experience.
Yeah.
And I have a lot to learn and I'm just interested in the conversation. I really mm-hmm. am. And I think Metal Up Your Podcast is a really cool place that we've built over here where this kind of nuanced thing can happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
So listen, if it's something you want to write in about and give us your perspective, it's metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com. You can leave us a positive review. We are doing the patches this month. When is your album coming out?
I don't have an exact date yet. So everything just got sent off to get pressed on vinyl mm-hmm. in last week. I'll set a date once I know when that's going to be, like when I have a general idea of when the vinyl's going to be done. Because it's tough. It's way longer right now than normal as far as turnaround time.
Okay.
So I will get it to the Kickstarter backers before then for sure.
Cool.
But as far as the general public, when you can, if you didn't get involved in the Kickstarter, when you can pre-order the vinyl because there will be leftovers. I'll figure that out soon and we'll talk about it. Don't worry.
All right, and go down to the link below this and RSVP to that Metal Up Your Podcast Night Between Party, which is going to be on September 25th. It's going to give, you know, our buddies Anthony and Namarda, who are kind of helping put it together, it's going to give them an idea about what kind of venue to book for the event. And it's going to be a shitload of fun. You guys are going to have a good time.
Yeah, always. And,
always.
Always, man.
And as always, we love and appreciate you out there. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your families. Take care of your dog.
Especially.
Peace.
Adios.
If you were our advisor, what would you say? Then I would say, delete that.